Blog Talk Radio.
Mama Africa, Mama Africa, I'm coming home. Hello, hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I'm feeling fine, and I hope you're fine too. Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I'm hoping you hear these words. Your grace turned blue, grace turned blue. I'm saying these words to let you know how much I care, and I won't let go. Even though we're oceans away, you're
another episode of Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon, and once again, we're blessed with a wonderful guest that is equipped with a ton of knowledge, a ton of experience to put things in a deeper context. And today, among other things, we're going to be talking about the impact that the capitalistic beast has had upon communities of color throughout, not just the U.S., but throughout the world, looking at the African communities throughout the U.S., black and brown, black and Latino communities throughout the U.S., Central America, South America, Africa, and we're going to be delving into their capitalistic roots in terms of when we look at the prison industrial complex, we look at this global financial crisis that was irrefutably connected to capitalistic greed entrenched here within the belly of the beast, otherwise known as the United States of America. And we're joined by none other than my comrade, Omari Musa. He's had a ton of experience. He's had over 40 years of experience as a revolutionary. And I mean, and that's really the crux of this show. I want to, you know, I brought Omari on to talk about how we can use revolutionary tactics and what are revolutionary tactics? How can we use revolutionary tactics to improve the living conditions of people who have been historically oppressed by oppression, white supremacy, racism, capitalism. And, you know, so he's going to talk to us about his experiences as an organizer, as a real community organizer, as an activist, someone who has been a strong supporter of Fidel Castro and the Cuban Revolution. And we look at Cuba, we see, I mean, when we talk about this healthcare debate, and it's just almost comical, but you have to laugh to keep from crying. But it's really sad when we look at, you know, this day, September 29th, 2009, where the Senate just voted against the public option. And as we know, if we've been following this, that the public option is in itself a watered-down version of a truly single-payer option, which is what is needed. And so the fact that this was even the public option, the watered down, the diluted public option, was even voted against, you know, by the Senate, it's really sad times in the U.S. because profits before people reign supreme, seems to reign supreme in Washington. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Omari Musa. Welcome to the show, brother. I've kind of given the listeners a brief snippet of the long list of work that you've done. But if you could introduce yourself to the listeners and kind of tell them a little bit more about yourself and who you are and what you stood for throughout your life.
Well, thank you, Solomon, for the big introduction. I've been a revolutionary for more than 40 years. I'm a activist in the Socialist Workers Party. The main reason I became a socialist was because of several things as a youth. One was the question of the war in Vietnam, support to Cuba, segregation in the United States, and that is the fight for African-American liberation. Those were the three major things in my youth that moved me towards joining a revolutionary movement in the United States. I don't really want to dwell too much on a lot of the things that I may have done in the past. I think the current economic crisis that's confronting working people of all nationalities in the United States, but around the world as well, this is the first time that there has been truly a world economic depression. In the depression that people talk about in the 30s, most of the people, those of us who lived in the third world, India, China, most of Africa, really weren't drawn into the capitalist world order. But now we are. So all of those countries that now produce raw materials have seen a tremendous drop in their income because the price of those materials is so low. Hunger, starvation, illiteracy, lack of education, lack of development reign supreme in what people used to call the third world. I was just reading an article today where 52% of people in the age of 16 to 24 years old in the United States are unemployed today. 52%. That's official figures. You know, in the African American and the Latino community, those figures are higher. So the real question is on that. It's a function of the capitalist system, as you pointed out. It's not good officials in office, bad officials in office, demagogic officials in office. These are all politicians, black, white, Latino, male, female, who serve the system under which we live. That is capitalism, a system of exploitation and oppression. Now, we in the Socialist Workers Party think that we are quite capable and competent working people here of actually overthrowing this beast. And that's what we've dedicated our lives to. That is the building of a revolutionary movement in the United States that will take the power, economic and social, out of the hands of the ruling rich and put it in the hands of working people on the land and in the cities, in industry and in agriculture, so that we can organize a society based on human need and our profit. I mean, that's the only way out of the crisis that we face. If we don't do that, the capitalist system will survive. It will not fall under its own weight. It must be overthrown. If we don't overthrow it, it will simply wait out the crisis, destroy thousands and thousands and millions of human beings and productive capacity to get back on its feet and go through another period of economic growth where we will be the victims once again.
Right. And I think that's a great segue to my first question, because I want to actually just start at a very rudimentary point, because it seems to me that, as I observed this past election, this past presidential election, you know, sadly people were mistaken by calling, president-elect then, or even presidential candidate then, Obama, a socialist. And I would always say to myself and to my friends, I wish that were the case, but that's clearly not the case. And I would have these conversations with folks, like, you know, in terms of, like, do you really even know what socialism is? And based on just, like, the corporate media, which is an apparatus and an appendage of the capitalist system, the misinformation that's out there is quite deliberate. And so I want to ask you a question. Can you explain to our listeners, like, what is socialism? What is socialism, and how can it benefit our society?
Well, the first thing I said is we need to take note of. Working people need to through revolutionary action take the political and economic power out of the hands of the ruling rich, and set up their own government, and thereby opening the door to the real end of exploitation and oppression. We don't have a blueprint of what socialism looks like or a guide map. That lays in the future for working people to organize and decide. But the other thing is that the problems that confront us are problems that we need to work, that we need to end now. We, for example, raise what we call immediate demand to benefit working people on the land and in the city. The war in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq must cease. All of the U.S. troops and the troops from all of the capitalist powers must be withdrawn, period. That's one thing that's in the interest of working people. The current worldwide economic crisis and the way it affects us, unemployment needs to be addressed. How do you address that? Jobs for all. Build the things that we as working people need, hospitals, schools, child care centers, free and equal education for all, from cradle to grave. How will you finance that? Abolish the military budget.
Right.
Questions like the death penalty. That only really applies to working people. The ruling rich don't get put on trial by anybody, and certainly don't get the death penalty. It's a weapon to demoralize working people, and those of us who are working people are the only ones to suffer. Troy Davis, for example, in Savannah, Georgia, is one of the latest examples where this weapon has been used, and the fight that has been put up by his family and others around the world to make the U.S. Supreme Court and the authorities, judicial authorities, grant him a new trial in the face of evidence that suggests very strongly that he's innocent is a testament to what we can do as working people. Let me give you another example. You mentioned the so-called debate around health care. Well, it's not a debate around health care, as most people really, really know in their bones. It's what health care for everyone is very simple. We call for universal free health care for everybody, period. How's that go? Nobody argues about how you're going to finance new weapons for the U.S. military. That's not even discussed. We say take the money from this military and tax the rich, so that the things that we need and jobs can be created. It's not like things don't need to be built and organized. It's that they're not profitable to do, so they're not simply not done under capitalist system. without the pressure of working people jamming them up, no change is made. The example is that's often cited is the civil rights movement. Most people don't really have a real grasp of what actually happened. But it was tens and tens of millions of blacks, Latinos, and others who forced the government to grant these concessions. And as soon as you stop fighting, they begin to take them all back. Visit the question of health care and what is being attacked. That is, Medicare is being attacked right now by the Obama administration. Now, people have illusions because we understand that people won't fight for revolution tomorrow. But we have to fight around things that are in our interest today. The Obama administration, in fact, is simply an extension of the Bush administration. If you just go through the list of wars, attacks on democratic rights, the cutbacks in health care, the attack on the right of a woman to have an abortion, all of these things were implemented or started long before Bush, actually, much of it under the Clinton administration and the Ronald Reagan administration. This has been a decades-long attack on the living standards and the rights of working people. But we won't move. Here's the trick. The rulers have two parties. One's called the Democrats, the other's called the Republicans. They rule through trickery by getting us to support one candidate or another of those two parties. And they simply change the names of the individuals who run in each party. Joseph Biden, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and you can go on in terms of the Democrats and Republicans. But the basic fundamental trajectory of those parties is to defend the interests of the super rich in the United States and their interests around the world. And they have no interest whatsoever in the interests of working people in the United States. So, I mean, it's a concrete thing. It's not an abstraction whether Obama's a socialist or not. Everybody knows he's not a socialist. He's a politician in the cut of many other politicians who simply is, as I put it, now the current head of the empire. That's all he is. Bush was the head of the empire before that. William Clinton was the head of the empire before that. And through all of these administrations so far, there have been attacks on our rights and our living standards. And every working person out there knows it. It just didn't drop from the sky. It's organized by the rulers of this country through their government.
Right. I mean, you brought up a good point in a couple of things, a few good points that kind of stuck out at me with what you just said. You mentioned, you know, kind of allude to the fact that it took, you know, a critical mass of people of color, you know, black people, Latinos, indigenous folks, you know, and others, you know, poor whites, working class whites that got it, that really fought for, you know, some tangible concrete changes that we would see societally. And it seems that you know, a lot of people have become kind of pacified, and I've always looked up to elders like yourself, folks who came from the generation before mine, in terms of like the long hours and days and weeks and months and years that you guys put into the struggle so that we could continue to fight with a new set of tools, continue to fight till there's truly an egalitarian society. We don't live in that yet. But what I saw in this last, you know, election campaign, especially once President-elect, you know, Obama became president, is that, you know, I saw the T-shirts come out, the T-shirts juxtaposing Obama, you know, who, as you said, you duly noted, it is a politician, juxtaposing him to either King or El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz, otherwise known as Malcolm X. And it was just kind of like very like disconcerting to see that, because they're two polar opposites. And you know, and I saw one T-shirt that says, oh, they didn't give us 40 acres of mule, but we got the White House. And I'm like, this dude is not all of a sudden a panacea on, you know, all of these social issues that have been inflicted upon indigenous people in this country, Latinos, you know, black and brown people, you know, in this country, and he's proven that. And so I wanted to ask you a question about when you said it's what he represents right now is an extension of the Bush regime. One thing that the Bush regime, you know, initiated, I believe it was in 2007 or February of 2008, was this AFRICOM, and you know, which is Africa Command, and it's to me, you know, it's all the trappings of neocolonization throughout the continent of Africa to strategically secure through military, you know, partnerships, secure Africa's precious mineral resource. We all know that the continent of Africa is the most minerally rich in the entire world. What do you see the role, AFRICOM plays, not just within this administration, but within the nefarious goals of the U.S. empire, and how can on the backside of it, how can people galvanize and mobilize to fight things like this, and to also fight for the ending of, you know, and I'd like to get your take on, you know, Cuba 5 and also, you know, things that we see, you know, going on with trying to, like, end the embargo in Cuba, which Obama, coincidentally, has just extended for an additional year.
Well, as I said, the policies and the politics of the Obama administration are an extension of those of the Bush administration, and it reflects the needs of the ruling rich, not working people. The trap of the Democratic and Republican Party have us arguing over which devil do we support. The idea is to get rid of the devils and the system that they propagate. So the question is AFRICOM. AFRICOM is a military set up by the United States government to be able to move quickly on the African continent to make sure servants for U.S. interests against the interests of Germany, France, and the other imperialist powers are guaranteed militarily. So they will put in dictators, as they have done in Somalia, who have no support whatsoever amongst the Somali people, and back that up with military special forces. That is what's going on around AFRICOM. As a matter of fact, AFRICOM is not even based in the African countries because it would be too embarrassing politically for any of the African regimes, neo-colonial that they are, to actually host an agent of U.S. imperialism in their country. AFRICOM is based in Stuttgart, Germany. But what's also important here is not just AFRICOM. There is a U.S. North America command that includes Canada, the United States, and Mexico. The North American command, which allows the United States to use its military to defend the interests of the ruling rich in this country, to move militarily anywhere in the northern hemisphere, inclusive of Mexico. So they have set these military institutions up to be able to move to defend their interests, and Africa is one of them. As you said, Africa has abundant natural and human resources, but today those resources are under the leadership, if you will, the misleadership of those who cooperate with imperialism, whether it be France, whether it be the United Kingdom, or whether it be the United States. The United States is the big cop on the scene. Now, the other thing you mentioned about Cuba, I'm glad you mentioned Cuba. The Obama administration just extended the embargo. That means that no trade between, except a small amount that's allowed, can be carried on legally with the United States. It also means, through some of the other laws that the United States government has created throughout the various Democratic and Republican administrations, going back to the John Fitzgerald Kennedy administration, U.S. citizens can't travel to Cuba. You have to get special permission, and that permission is denied 90%+ of the time, as well as Cubans coming to the United States. Now, you mentioned so we call for the end of that embargo, no more embargo against Cuba, full normalization of all trade, economic, and social relations between the United States and Cuba. Not complicated. The case of the Cuban Five is another point. These are five revolutionary brothers who came to the United States, two of whom are citizens of the United States, whose assignment was to become part of these right-wing groups that predominate in southern Florida. I lived in Miami right before I came here to Washington, D.C. And from the point of the Cuban Revolution in 1959 until today, those groups have been organizing attacks on the Cuban mainland and the Cuban people. So these brothers' assignment was to get information on when these groups were going to attack Cuba. And the United States government knew about all of these attacks on Cuba and allowed them to continue, up to and including the so-called incident with the brothers to the rescue in 1996. These brothers were put in jail by the United States on conspiracy charges of violating certain U.S. laws. None of the things they did threatened any U.S. interest whatsoever. But it's really the fault of the United States government that has not stopped these right-wing groups from carrying out their activities and financing them to a certain degree. But they've been in jail for over 10 years, going on 11 years, this very month of September, and have had sentences of 15 years and up. One of the brothers who is accused of being a complicit in the shootdown in 1996 of the Brothers to the Rescue planes that flew over Cuba was charged with conspiracy to commit murder. Now, three of them are having their sentences reviewed because of the length of their sentences. We call for, and many others, many others, thousands around the world have called for their freedom, and we continue to do that. We urge teach-ins, protests to begin to explain to more and more of the people here in the United States as well as around the world the true facts of the case and put the blame where it belongs on the United States government, not on these five brothers in jail. So that's one of the things that we campaign around, and people around the world have actually been campaigning around. They had 13 amicus briefs, the largest number of amicus briefs submitted to the Supreme Court when the Supreme Court of the United States reviewed their cases, which they turned down, the Supreme Court turned down. So this is part of the system to punish the Cuban Revolution for being so uppity as to stand up against the United States for the last 50 years and demand the dignity and sovereignty of the people of Cuba. And we stand 100% with the Cuban Revolution and urge other working people in the United States to emulate the revolutionary course that the Cuban government has taken since 1950. If they can do it, we can do it.
And it's also, since we spoke about Africa, it's also good to mention for those that don't know, and you know very well, Mari, that Cuba has been a great, great friend to the continent of Africa, you know, in terms of sending, you know, well over 300,000 troops, you know, to help fight for the black liberation struggle throughout many parts of southern Africa. And also, you know, they helped in the struggle in Algeria. And so that's one of the big reasons that, you know, when I was younger, that really endeared me to Cuba is like, wow, this is just amazing. You know what I'm saying? And this wasn't anything that was taught, and nor do I necessarily expect to be taught in any public school system or private schools, you know, in the United States of America. But it should be definitely duly noted the sacrifices and the internationalist solidarity that Cuba and Fidel Castro have had with many, many nations throughout the continent of Africa in their struggle for liberation.
Yeah, it's an interesting point because you mentioned the question of the fight against the apartheid invasion of Angola, where the Cuban government responded to the request of the Angolan government for technical help in turning back the invasion of the South African apartheid regime. This went on until the late 1980s, this support, both in terms of troops and others. But the Cuban Revolution itself was based on internationalism from the beginning. You mentioned Algeria. That was one of their first missions, that is to provide technical assistance to the fight against French colonialism in Algeria. They brought the children of revolutionaries who were killed, that is Algerian children, to Cuba to get medical care and foster homes as that struggle was going on, and they provided medical aid to the fighters in Algeria itself. They supported the Palestinian struggle for self-determination from the very, very beginning. They toured, their leaders toured the world. When there's a, even today, when there is a catastrophe presented by nature in much of the third world, the Cubans provide free of charge medical help and all kinds of help, not just to Africa, but to Latin America and other countries. When Katrina hit the United States, the Cuban government proposed sending 1,500 personnel, medical personnel, evacuation personnel to help the situation in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, and the United States government refused that aid. This is while more than 1,600 people died that we know of in the area because of the callousness of the campless government here, who had no interest in defending the interests or the lives of working people in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. This is an example of the internationalism of the Cuban Revolution from the very beginning up to and including today. You want medical care in Cuba is free because of the revolution, from cradle to grave. Education in Cuba is free from cradle to grave. It has one of the most democratic systems in the world. That's one of the things that will be debated. Now, I'm working with others to try to get two Cuban students to the United States, to tour the United States, to explain what life in Cuba is about, so that people can hear the real life experiences coming from those who are in Cuba, who tour the United States, and take on any questions that people here may have. There's more interest in Cuba today than I think any time before, because people want to know, what is this thing called Cuba? How can they provide medical care, this little poor country? How can they aid victims of earthquakes in Pakistan with medical help and other procedures? How is it that when there are hurricanes that hit Cuba, none or very, very, very few people die? And in the case of the United States, any natural disaster results in the death of working people in the United States. These natural disasters are combined with the man-made disaster of the capitalist system itself. You know, they can get 200,000 soldiers to Afghanistan and Iraq, but they can't save the lives of, people in New Orleans or along the Mississippi River when it floods and so on. This is the capitalist system as it really stands. And this is what the Cuban Revolution stands out, and most people in the world know that it stands out as a different kind of place.
Right. And anyone that, as Namari said, if anyone that has any questions, you know, you can, the phone lines are open now. You can call in. It should be on your screen, but if you don't have, so if you're listening by phone, the number is 347-945-5191. Once again, that's 347-945-5191. If you have any questions or comments, you want to join the dialogue, or, you know, if you just want to continue listening, that's fine as well. Amari, I'm going to ask also at the end of the show, but I wanted to take this, you know, brief moment to ask you if you could give the listeners any contact information that you might want to, if someone's listening and says, I want to, you know, be a part of this Cuban cultural exchange in terms of, you know, lending my resources, you know, available to help out with this cultural exchange, or if somebody wants to become a part of the Socialist Workers Party or learn more about your organization, how might they get in contact with you or the organization in general?
Well, around the Cuban Student Exchange that I just spoke about, the listeners and viewers should contact you as one of the coordinators, the coordinator in the Washington, Greater Washington metropolitan area, through the Embro Center at the University of Maryland at College Park. That would be one direct way to actually get involved in this, a call or an email to you about wanting to be involved in getting these Cuban students here, getting professors to invite them to speak in the United States should be directed to you. I think that would be a good place to start. Those who are interested in the Young Socialists, the youth organization, affiliated with the Socialist Workers Party or the party itself can contact us quite easily. We have an office here in Washington, D.C. Our address is 143 Kennedy Avenue, Kennedy Street, Northwest, Suite 15. And our telephone number is 202-536-5080. So you can contact us very easily. As a matter of fact, usually on Friday evenings, we have a political talk and forum on different political topics in the that are of interest to working people and young people who want change in the United States and around the world. And those events are held usually at 7 p.m. at the address I just gave, 143 Kennedy Northwest, Suite 15 in Washington, D.C. And the number is 202-536-5080. So you can call us or come by our office. We have a room full of revolutionary books by revolutionary leaders from Nelson Mandela to Fidel Castro to Thomas Sankara from Burkina Faso, Malcolm X, a revolutionary brother who tried to point the way in the United States, and many of us are his followers. So if you're interested in reading up on this stuff, everything from Marx and Engels to today, you should come by our book center at 143 Kennedy Northwest, Suite 15.
Definitely, definitely. If anyone wants to contact me in terms of the Cuban student cultural exchange, you can do so by emailing me at just simply Solomon, S-O-L-O-M-O-N, at umd.edu. Amar, I had a question that I was hoping you could shed some light. When you were talking about the Cuban Five and how they've been persecuted based on these trumped-up charges of terrorism and this, that, and the other, what's interesting to me is if you could talk about the blatant hypocrisy that's going on with the U.S. government in terms of the fact that the U.S. government is harboring a known terrorist that played a part in blowing up a Venezuelan aircraft. If you could tell us about who that individual is and just kind of a background on that story, because I think that's an interesting one that we should be duly noted, just based on the kind of like the accusations that have been trumped up against the Cuban Five, and the kind of the hypocrisy that lingers around this case about gentleman by the name of, I believe, Jose Carriles.
Yes, Posada Carriles, a former Cuban who fought against the Cuban Revolution, helped to organize bandits and criminals who attacked Cuba in the what's called in the United States the Bay of Pigs invasion, organized and led by the John F. Kennedy administration and with the support and enthusiasm of the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency. He's one of their operatives. Today functions in the streets of Miami, free. He said in an interview with the New York Times some years ago in the 90s that he helped organize, that he was the lead organizer of the bombing of a Cuban airliner that had 70-odd people on board, that all of whom were killed. He was trained by the United States Central Intelligence Agency and functioned that way. He carried out the same kinds of activities, terrorist activities, in Venezuela, where he went and was a supporter of the previous regime that existed there that oppressed the people of Venezuela, and was in fact in jail and escaped jail in Venezuela while he was actually on trial. And the Venezuelan government today demands the United States government extradite him so that he can be put on trial and judged by the people of Venezuela for his crimes. So this is a part. He runs the streets. In the first years after the Cuban Revolution, Miami and its environs were free territory for all of these counter-revolutionaries. They organized many groups who attacked Cuba. They bombed sugarcane fields. They attacked Cuban citizens in Cuba. They attacked U.S. citizens and others in the United States. They were responsible for the bombing that killed a diplomat in here in Washington, D.C. in the 90s and one of his aides. This is the kind of activity the United States carries on. We leave That does not leave aside the mass murder that they've committed against the people of Iraq and are in the process of committing against the people of Afghanistan and Pakistan today. That is the kind of government, a government of the rich, that defends their interests, not the interests of working people.
Right. Thanks. I really appreciate that. And it's amazing. And it kind of like when you just mentioned, when you're talking about what is being inflicted upon the people of Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, it ties into the military-industrial complex that you mentioned at the beginning of the show, and how that's one of the quickest, most direct routes to finance a fully funded universal healthcare system. Because when you look at Venezuela, you know, spends a very, very small amount of money compared to the U.S. You know, it's a little over $1 billion towards their military. Cuba spends, I think, less than $1 billion towards its military. And we look at, you know, the amount of money that the U.S. spends militarily each year. I mean, it's damn near close to $1 trillion each year. And, you know, they want to quibble about, you know, $1 trillion that might be spent over 10 years towards, you know, saving people's lives, towards preserving people's lives, towards preventing, you know, diseases and sicknesses, maladies and so forth. They say no, but when it comes to destroying, you know, people's lives through, you know, manless drones that we see being, being sent to places of Pakistan, whether it's the Swat Valley or Afghanistan, the bombings that have occurred throughout Iraq, and people don't know that it's been, you know, close to a million innocent civilians have lost their lives in Iraq. You know, in wars of today, you know, over 90% of the casualties are civilians. And it's just a stark reminder, you know, how capitalism is inextricably linked to the military and what is developed into this complex, a military industrial complex. And we see the prison industrial complex. How can regular people come together to stop this machine from continuing to snowball and pick up momentum? You know, because I heard you, I was at an event with you last Wednesday when Abioma Ezekwe was speaking at the Nimbrua Cultural Center, and you had some really profound words, some really profound and strong words, and it was a rallying cry to me, you know, and I hope other people, you know, felt, you know, the reverberations of your words within them to, you know, to how we might be able to galvanize and to not negotiate with this beast, not say, oh, let's have a merger of socialism and capitalism, you know, not to negotiate with capitalism, but to defeat it. And how, if you could kind of repeat some of the things that you've said, how can this beast, this machine be defeated?
Well, we have a weekly newspaper. It's called The Militant, and it's bilingual in English and Spanish. It's called in Spanish El Militante. And every week, our paper has articles of analysis and fact about what is really happening around the world as well as in the United States. And your listeners and those who are watching on the net can get The Militant. For $5, you get 12 weeks of The Militant mailed to your house. And if you're interested in that, you should contact us at our number, 202-536-5080, or come to our office at 143 Kennedy Northwest, Suite 15, and get a subscription to our newspaper, or at least get a copy. For example, what we're trying to do is build a revolutionary movement in the United States. We don't have any illusions that people all of a sudden will wake up and say we need to overthrow the government. But it's through our own struggles, just like it was in the movement against for civil rights, as it's commonly called amongst blacks, which was an impetus to a movement amongst Latinos in the United States, as well as women demanding our rights. It was a part of the fight against the war in Vietnam, which was not in the interest of working people here, and had, as wars of imperialism, millions of casualties. A movement can be organized against the capitalist system, and it begins around the immediate demands. I'll give one example. when the U.S. government was threatening to implement what they call immigration reform, because all of a sudden immigrants from other countries are the enemies of working people in the United States. It's actually quite the contrary. Immigrants come with their experiences and struggles from other countries and add to our consciousness in the United States and help broaden that. But when that was threatened, millions of Latinos and supporters of legalization of immigrants hit the streets in the United States. This was just in 2006. And it defeated the attempts by the Congress to impose draconian laws against immigrant workers in the United States. But the rulers keep chipping away and trying to get it. It's a matter of divide and conquer. Immigrant workers are not enemies to working people who are native-born in the United States, but allies. And any people who've been involved in any kinds of social struggles, it doesn't matter what language you speak or what country you speak. If you work in a plant where there's speed up, you come from one country and I come from the United States, our enemy is not each other. Our enemy is the boss who runs it and the politicians who will mobilize the police to attack us on a picket line. They never attack the boss. They always attack the working people. So we say that native-born workers have to support the right of immigrant workers to legalization to begin to build the unity that's needed to build this revolutionary movement. Much the same was with the civil rights movement. You couldn't build a revolutionary movement in the United States based on segregation and the division of the races across the board, socially, economically, and every other way, based on one group being higher and scapegoating another group, that is, people who are not African Americans, scapegoating those who are black. And that movement, the civil rights movement, in a short span of years, you know, no more than 10, 12 years, actually changed the consciousness of people in the United States so that racism is now looked upon not just by African Americans and not just by Latinos, but the majority of people in the United States of whatever nationality as an evil, something to be fought. And that's the beginning steps of changing the consciousness of people. The demonstrations around demanding freedom for Troy Davis is another example. His family has been exemplary in holding the line and saying the brother's innocent and should be let free, and going through all of the motions and what was necessary, including mobilizations, teach-ins, educationals around the United States and the world to explain the real facts of the case. This helps build the movement. A movement against the United States involvement with troops and other and its allies in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq helps to build a revolutionary movement in the United States. A fight around the right of women to choose whether or not to bear children is a part of building the revolutionary movement. This, too, is a right that has been chipped away at since 1973 when it was when abortion was decriminalized in the United States, because of the threat of a mass movement that would demand that. That was beginning to start then. But ever since then, it's been chipped away. It's been made more difficult for women to exercise their right of choice. They have to travel distances. Young women have to get parental permission. There's no abortion services in the areas where they live, so they have to take off time of work. This, too, is a part of the attack on working people in the United States. And these kinds of issues that are clouded or misinformation distributed by the schools, the churches, and every other institution in the United States can be countered to a small degree by actually reading things like newspapers like The Militant that give you the accurate information. We don't say that we're we say right up front on the front page of our paper that we are published in the interest of working people, not in the interest of some abstract truth. There are two truths. There's the truth of the rulers, and there's what affects the working people. And our paper is on the side. So those are part of the things that we have to do. We have to fight against the cutbacks in education. Students have to get out. Professors have to get out. And those who think that education should be a right have to mobilize to do that. And that's what's beginning to happen. We have to rebuild the labor movement in the United States around these kinds of issues, social issues, as well as what used to be called bread and butter issues of wages and working conditions, so that the labor movement will become part of the instrument to build a revolutionary movement in the United States. And that's what's coming at us. That's what's coming at us in this economic, worldwide economic crisis and depression today.
See, you're saying that this current economic crisis is probably waking some folks up to the realities of you know, of what the society around them has built up, you know, over not just years or decades, but centuries, and people are you think are more than ever perhaps amenable to the idea of looking at alternative means than, you know, the capitalist system that most people in this country were born under. Is that what you're kind of saying?
Yeah, many of us, because this economic crisis hit so hard for the tens of millions of us working people so quickly, it was like somebody gave you a hard punch in the stomach. You know, it takes us time to recover and to organize ourselves to fight and to begin to eliminate those things that are not in our interest. I mentioned earlier the fact that they, as Malcolm X put it, the Democratic and Republican parties is really one party, and the individuals they put up really defending interests of the rich. That's the shell game they've got us tracked into. That's why, for example, when Obama cried for change, he got the response. People wanted change, but we're still locked in the framework of change in the context of the capitalist system, and that simply doesn't work. That they have run the United States for 150 years since the Civil War, and here we are in the situation we're in. So it takes us a little time to begin to actually organize ourselves to see more clearly that the fight is not just an economic fight. It's a political fight more than anything else, and that is what we try to focus on. We need a political and class break of working people, whether we're on the land, raising food and crops for working people to eat, or whether we're working people in the cities who are working now or trying to find a job. We need to organize our own political instrument, a party of working people, a labor party, to actually fight politically against the Democrats and Republicans and the interests that they represent. That is the interests of the multi-billionaires who actually run major industries, decide whether or not we have a job, decide whether or not we have health care. They're the ones that decide, not us. If a poll was put to the people of the United States whether or not we should have medical care for all, it would overwhelmingly win. But that's not the question. What's the question is how much will it cost and what this and that, none of which has anything to do with providing health care for working people and anybody else in the United States. That's one of the examples that I point to.
That's right. And so you even see a world, because you mentioned education, which is something like near and dear to my heart and probably near and dear to all of our listeners' hearts, is that, you know, moved away from this current system, we could also potentially see, you know, free funding of education, not just, you know, through primary and secondary, but also through tertiary education, the same way we see in some other countries, some, you know, Western European countries, but also Venezuela, I believe Cuba as well. Am I accurate with that as well, where we could see, you know, students being able to go to public universities in this country for free? Is that also part of the vision of a socialist society?
Well, I think that would be one of the first things that would be implemented by a government of workers and farmers. That is to abolish the cost for working people to have the very simple things of life, education, real education, medical care, a job for everybody at a decent wage where we can earn a living. When I talk about education, I don't mean just going to school. There, in Cuba, for example, there are myriad of ways that people get education. Suppose you don't want to go to college. Suppose you want to be an auto mechanic. You should have free education so that you can become the best auto mechanic in the world. You go to a hospital for medical care, and the first thing they ask you is, do you have insurance? What has that got to do with your medical problem? Nothing. It's all based on profit. And we say that working people, when we organize our own government, will institute these things quite easily, and they will be quite uniformly welcomed by working people as we struggle. Let me make one thing clear. We're talking about tens and tens of millions of people, who working people in the United States, who decide this kind of a course in action through their own experiences, not something that would be dictated to them by a small group or anything else, but it will be the actions of the masses themselves through the things that they need. We did not get what we today call civil rights because somebody signed a piece of paper. We got it through the selfless struggle of tens of millions of people in the United States who demanded that Jim Crow, the system of legal segregation, had to go. And we killed it. There's still racism. There's still oppression. There's still discrimination. That's the next phase that we have to attack. And that really can only be solved when the capitalist system, which is the root of the problem, because it continues to reproduce these things like racism and exploitation, when that system is actually destroyed and a new system based on human needs is created by working people in the United States. That's the task that lies before us. And I'm fully confident that working people will do that, not because I can look into a crystal ball and see the future, but because it flows from the antagonism between working people and the capitalist system. There is an antagonism that cannot be glossed over, that cannot be, in the fundamental sense, reformed. And as we go through struggles, as we fight for our rights as working people, as we fight for the rights of working people around the world in solidarity with their struggles, we will gain the revolutionary consciousness to understand that a new system is required. It's not a snap of the finger thing, it's a process. Every revolution is a process and is made by the millions, not by good people in office.
Right. Well, that's like about, unfortunately, man, the all the time that we have today. I wish we could go on and on, but I would like to, on behalf of Your World News and all the listeners, I'd like to thank you, Brother Amari, for not just for this conversation, but for all the sacrifices you've made throughout the civil rights movement and all the sacrifices you're continuing to make in the struggle. Because, you know, people should know that, you know, being, you know, a revolutionary and being, you know, truly revolutionary in your actions, you know, there are some sacrifices that you make along the way on behalf of many, 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 many people. And so I'd like to thank you for that. And I also like to keep the door wide open for you as a guest on this show in the future. I'd love to have you on the show again many times again on this show, because you're able to put things into a context that I found extremely refreshing and educational. And I think that's also one of those steps in terms of, you know, galvanizing and mobilizing people, is to educate them around the issues, the critical issues that purposefully they've been misinformed about in mainstream outlets, whether it's educational mainstream outlets or the media. I'd like to thank you. But you can have the last word.
Let me just say one thing, because this is not an individual thing of Omari Musa. We need to build a revolutionary movement, and your listeners there are the future leaders of this revolutionary movement. And I urge them to contact us and to get a subscription to the Militant newspaper. And I urge them to participate in every action demanding the rights of working people and youth in the United States and around the world. And I urge them to contact us at 143 Kennedy Northwest, Suite 15, 202-536-5080, for us to continue this discussion about how we're going to fight to bring into being a world based on human needs and not profit.
Thank you so much. And please take him up on that offer. And it's an outstanding publication, The Militant. And so, you know, definitely please take him up on that offer. You can Google The Militant, and you can also, you know, if you're in the Washington, D.C. area, but, you know, or you're in, you know, New York City, there are branches there for you to go and visit. So I hope people, you know, take him up on his offer and start to educate yourself. And The Militant is a great publication as a starting a point of departure, I should say, towards that process. So thank you once again, Omari. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Solomon, and your readers and your listeners.
All right, and I just want to leave us with a song that I've grown to enjoy playing at the end of this program. And this is Uno the Prophet. It was a MC for a non-corporate MC from Boston, Massachusetts, and this is a song that you will never ever hear on corporate radio or on corporate television. It's 1 million Africans. This is the kind of hip-hop that I support. Thank you, and I'll see you in a short couple weeks when we're going to have a special tribute to the life and times of the great murderer, plunderer, rapist known as Christopher Columbus, and putting his life and times in further context where, unfortunately, in far too many regions of this country, we celebrate this this evil person's life. So we'll see you soon. This is 1 million Africans.
This song probably been done about a million times, but it ain't never been done like mine. We're talking about a million Africans. We're talking about 10 million Africans. We're talking about 100 million Africans. We're talking about the genocide that went down in Rwanda. We're talking about Darfur. We're talking about Sierra Leone. We're talking about a million diamonds. We're talking about the Congo, B. We're talking about a million of our people in prison. We're talking about a million of our people dead, unemployed, homeless, hungry, B. 1 million Africans. 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans.
1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans.
They say we don't got no right to complain. I just laugh at them. You can have the whips and the chains. I don't hate on them, but hopefully they gonna catch up. I ain't gonna wait on them. Kanye, Lupe, Pharrell, I will skate on them. 1 million black men locked up in prison.
Hold it down.
Think I'm kidding what it is, but I isn't. And if you didn't know, it's just cause you ignorant. Cause pigs lock up motherfuckers just cause of the pigment. That is racial profiling. No, I'm not wilding. Y'all sucking jiving.
Yeah, it's about
grinning and smiling. 1 million people was here before they even came. And ever since they came, they just changed the game. They brought a few million more and then they changed our names back. Turn a double burner, come to burn your sister flame.
We gon' burn it down, baby.
1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans. 1 million Taino, 1 million Arawak, 10 million more of our people who ain't coming back. 10 million of our people with scars on their back.
Crackers tell me that it don't matter, but matter of fact,
I'm the surprise in the box, I will crack a jack. After that ain't nothing else to do but to holler black. 1 million kids who ain't got no options. Either they down with the goons or the goblins. 1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans. Drop them off here and now you is a Haitian. Drop you off here and now you is Jamaican. 1 million, 10 million, let's bring it back, man. Yes, they are the devil. What's the devil to a
black man?
Nathan, nothing. They ain't saying nothing. We don't need another old white man. Finger on the button, cause the last white man had that type of power. Had 6 million people taking gasoline showers. The Bible told me this world is ours. The meek shall inherit, but that's only to be cowards. One stupid white man can knock down 2 towers. Y'all niggas got it backwards. Y'all niggas got it backwards. 1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans. 1 million Wampanoags, 1 million Blackfeet, 1 million Navajo, 1 million Apache, 1 million Iroquois, 1 million Sioux. You done killed about a billion people, maybe even two. Would take a nation of millions, hold us back, I thought you knew. And everywhere they go, this is just how they do. Was 11 million Africans living around Soweto. 1 million white folks had them in the ghetto. The ghetto, the ghetto. You all love the ghetto. You talk about it so much, but we ain't seen no bread though.
Break them all.
I take 1 million, 2 million, 3 million, 4. Build a couple hundred schools, hit you for 4 million more. 1 million Haitians, refugees know the score. Cause you don't want 1 million motherfuckers at the door, man. I am Farrakhan and 1 million men marching. Approach me with caution, 1 million people watching. I do this so often. 1 million places on this earth, but I come from Boston. 1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans. 1 million Africans, 3 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans.
Harry and Dublin came too. We got a long legacy. This is how we do it. Uno the Prophet, Nat Turner, Devil Burner. 1 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans passed through that transatlantic slave trade, the African Holocaust. Don't forget. A million, 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 a million.